Hello, everybody. Welcome back to a spooky edition of Bald Move Prestige. That's right. Jim and I have decided to close out the month of October, the spookiest of all months, the scariest of all months, the most jack-o'-lantern Latin, the only really only jack-o'-lantern Latin.
Yeah. You can get away with a pumpkin unless, for Thanksgiving, but it's not going to have eyes.
Unless Jack Skellington gets his way one year. Confined to the month of October, and we decided to close out with some prestige horror. And what could be more prestigious, more horrific than the granddaddy, arguably, well, you might argue about this later on, very first slasher flick ever, 1960's Psycho, of course, directed by the great Alfred Hitchcock. I had a hitch in my cock right as I was trying to say his name. Wow. The great Alfred Hitchcock, master of suspense, screenplay written by Joseph Stefano, based on the novel Psycho by Robert Bloch. It stars Anthony Perkins, who unfortunately was pretty typecast after this movie. In fact, I can only think of one post-Psycho movie I've ever seen him in, Disney's 1979's The Black Hole.
I thought you were going to say Psycho 2, because he's also in that.
I've not seen any of the subsequent Psychos. Vera Miles, who we both saw in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. She was also in the other John Wayne vehicle, The Searchers. Also, John Gavin, who was Julius Caesar in Spartacus, also came out in 1960 by a great director, Stanley Kubrick. He's also in Thoroughly Modern Millie. Bald Move fans might, I don't know, old school Bald Move fans might recall that film. Also, Martin Balsam, who is probably most famous as the number one juror from 12 Angry Men. He also is in Breakfast at Tiffany's and All the President's Men. And of course, Janet Leigh, who starred previously to this in Little Women, and also Orson Welles' film noir classic Touch of Evil, which kind of inspired Hitchcock in some ways to try to outdo the old man, the dueling old men of cinema. This was a movie, and also the soundtrack was composed by Bernard Herrmann. And interestingly enough, it was so good that it actually changed Hitchcock's mind on what he wanted. He actually wanted the classic shower stabbing scene to be silent to emphasize the woman screaming and vulnerability. And Herrmann said, "Hold them on to my beer. let me do the greatest sound cue of all time." Yeah. And yeah, it's the distinctive freak, as timed with the slashing and whatnot, very effective.
Oh yeah.
So this is a very classic spooky film. It's an old film. It's shot in black and white. Although I always assumed it was because that's what movies were shot in. No, movies were well into the color era. This was kind of a passion project. Hitchcock wanted to break a lot of rules, transgress a lot of societal norms and values, and the studio said, well, if you want to do that, do it on your own fucking dime. So he had to pinch a lot of pennies. And still came up with something. So here's the thing. I'm stalling to get to the point, which is I didn't like this film.
Wow.
This film did not work on me. Some old movies, like I can think of like Casablanca, Maltese Falcon, that I unironically enjoy as a fairly modern piece of filmmaking. This movie does feel dated, but it is a movie that I nevertheless found myself admiring for all the reasons you admire. It's suspense. It's like, and the more I read about it, the more this really was a taboo, groundbreaking film that shocked audiences, both in the violence and the sensuality. This is the era where Dick Van Dyke was still getting into a separate bed with his wife on TV. it shows a toilet, the very first toilet shown on screen, flushing.
Oh my God,
that's where in the world, this is the first on-screen flush of a toilet. This is where the pee and the poop goes. Does Hitchcock know that? Or does he just think it's where you get rid of your shredded incriminating evidence? No, this must have been, and I was thinking that as I was watching this, what must it have been like to never seen someone stabbed with a knife, never see blood spatter on the walls, never see and to have a 4-minute scene dedicated to it. Some truly shocking visuals in this film.
And that's to say nothing of the final part of this film, which I'm sure would be more than taboo at the time. It would cause people to get up and leave the theater, I imagine.
So that's the thing. I did not like this film. I don't think it held up for me personally, but I do admire it, and I do admire its place in cinematic horror. What did you think, Jim? Have you seen Psycho before?
No. This is shockingly, this might be the most shocking thing about Psycho, is I've never seen it before. It's one of those classic horror films, and there are a few of those that are just, you know, they came out enough before my time that they weren't really like playing on television a lot at the time.
Right.
And so I didn't even see them in an edited form. And this is one, and I have somehow managed over the last, well, 20 years of this, I wasn't alive, last 60 years, to dodge any substantial spoilers about this movie, period.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I did not know what the end of this movie was all about. And so I felt like an audience member in 1960, though with very, very updated sensibilities. Like watching this, you know, this felt like an older movie. This wasn't shocking to me in really any way, because I've seen 1,000 horror movies that are, you know, 100 times worse than this. So, but I found myself like getting drawn into the story, and when the subversion comes, each time it comes, because it comes multiple times in the movie, right? There's a subversion with the protagonist who you think is going to be around and then gone. I fell for that. And then I was thinking, okay, what is this mystery with Norman and his mother and this killing? Like, how is this happening if his mother's been dead? And I'm trying to puzzle it all out in my head, thinking, oh, Norman swapped bodies and all. And I did not see the end of this movie coming in any way. And it totally mind fucked me. If you don't know anything about Psycho, it's still a very effective movie.
I'm so glad, because that's probably the explanation. This movie is so famous, and you know, I've talked about this before. Long before I saw a lot of horror films, I kind of dipped my toe in the water by watching those things where I can't remember from Bravo, Stars, or AMC or whatever, but they'd have the top 100 scariest movies, and it was like a 5-hour thing. They'd do like 20 movies an hour, and they would always have like these famous people, and like, you know, people like Clive Barker and different people on, talking about these great movies and their particular scenes. And it always end each like 3-minute set with like an iconic reveal from the movie. Right.
Yeah.
So like that thing just laid bare all, because I think at the bottom of the hour, every time you got to like movie number 80 or movie number 60 or movie number, they gave it a little bit extra juice. And Psycho is one of those ones that got a little extra juice. So they spent like 10 minutes talking about it. And they just walked you through the whole thing. Yeah, like, yeah. You know, had the like the chair going around revealing the, you know, you know what?
Yeah.
In case you want to have the gym experience, I'll just leave all this to your imagination. But they just really walked you through everything. So I found the experience of watching this film was oddly like I'm tapping my foot waiting for like, because I always.
Gotcha.
Oh, geez. I can't even talk about. No.
Okay.
But
okay.
I felt like I had. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because this is one of the most famous films with some of the most famous shots that have been lampooned and parodied and aped and imitated so many times. I can't even get into it without spoiling. But like, I thought a certain event happened like right away in the film, and I'm like waiting 45 minutes. It finally happens. And then it's just you're kind of waiting. Like, it seems, if you know all of the twist coming, it seems kind of like, well, Jesus Christ, of course, why are we belaboring this point? But it's so interesting that it completely worked on you.
Yeah, totally.
So cool. I hope this is an old ass film. Maybe other people have. I'm glad I didn't do a bunch of heavy fucking spoilers. So
yeah, and I'd seen a lot of those shots that you're talking about, right? I've seen the images of the reveals, but out of context and not really understanding like that this is part of Psycho. So
gotcha.
Yeah, when those things hit, I was like mind blown. Kind of stuff. I did enjoy the experience throughout, though. It wasn't like, oh, those were the big moments and that's all this movie really has going for it is the twists. I thought the performances were extremely effective, especially Norman Bates.
Sure.
What's that guy's name?
Anthony Perkins.
Yeah, he is great as Norman Bates. And I imagine in 1960.
Love his restaurants.
Right. Yes. In 1960, this was probably a very unconventional performance, is how I would probably assume it was.
And it seemed like that was a deliberate choice by Hitchcock. Like, you know, you've got this guy who was a rising star at the time, known for, he was kind of like, imagine if you, you know, like Jimmy Stewart is or Tom Hanks' spiritual successor, the Jimmy Stewart. Well, this was going to be the actual, like, you know, this is another Jimmy, all American, good looks, wholesome,
right,
open, honest performance. And Hitchcock saw that in him and subverted it.
Decided to ruin his career. Sure.
it's funny. Yeah, because I guess Perkins asked him when he was being cast, is like, do you think this is going to be bad for my career? And Hitchcock says, you know what? It might be, because it does trade on those strengths of his and completely kind of like hijack. And again, since this was so shocking at the time, I'm sure that it was just hard for, you know, to accept this. I think it's a little bit easier nowadays because we, you know, we see this stuff happen all the time. But it was harder back in the studio system where people were groomed for certain roles. Like,
yeah,
Vera Miles, the Janet Leigh's sister in this movie, was being groomed to be the next Grace Kelly for Hitchcock, the next great, you know, muse. And so people were kind of like in these roles, like you're either a leading man or your character, all that, even more so than it was today. So like if you get typecast as, you know, a serial killer,
a psycho
because this is all like loose. I don't want to get into much of the way of spoilers. So maybe we should just tell people what the movie is about, or like, you know, kind of what they're in for. And then we can just get into the spoilers and talk freely.
That sounds good.
OK, so Psycho is about a woman who is in love with a man who is encumbered by debt. And he's got a ex-wife who's he's paying alimony to. He can barely afford to pay rent in a shoebox thing. Doesn't it's the classic. He doesn't think he can marry this girl because he's too fucking broke. And she gets the idea to steal $40,000 from her boss and run off and start a new life with this man. And that's the set. She's going on the long drive to be with him, and she happens to stop at a hotel to rest for the night, and the movie goes places from there.
I assumed that's what this movie was going to be entirely, because obviously Hitchcock known for his suspense, right?
Sure.
His sense of paranoia, and using that for the audience. And
oh boy, there's a lot of that.
Like Rear Window, we watched that not too long ago, and there's so much suspense, so much paranoia in that movie. I expected, you know, when they start in with the paranoid stuff in this movie, I'm like, okay, that's what this movie's going to be, and I'm feeling it, and it's working.
Sure. Yep.
That's not exactly what this movie is.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, you mentioned Rear Window, which we both watched not even a year ago and quite enjoyed. Like, I think that worked almost 100% on almost every level it intended to. And this one, it just didn't for me. But, like, let's get into it, because you spoilers from here on out. So you mentioned that, like, you found the movie enjoyable to watch. And I guess I did, too. Like, I found myself kind of getting into the initial scene with Gavin and Leigh, you know, like it was sensual, you know, for the time. Like I clearly, like, she's wearing this very sexy bustier, they're laying on the same bed, tousled, they're talking about the great sex they just had, like already, like, you know, sensor alarm bells must be going off all over Hollywood. And that first shot that just slowly pushes in over the course, some crazy fucking zoom from across the city of Phoenix, Arizona, into this window. Like, it's a great scene, and it kind of engrosses you in, and it gives you that same kind of voyeuristic vibe that you got from Rear Window.
For sure.
And scenes like him having Norman Bates having dinner with this lady, surrounded by all these taxidermy birds of prey and all that, like that, there's stuff that just fucking works in this movie. But I just felt like I was always waiting for those shoes to drop, those things I knew that were coming. It's like,
gotcha.
And I was impatient, because here's the thing. I think this, like, it started in early. This movie, from my, it had a reputation for being a zigzag movie that you thought was going to be about this protagonist. You know, Janet Leigh at that point was, or Leigh was very famous. It'd be like Scarlett Johansson being in a movie. And I thought she dies within like 10 or 15 minutes.
Oh,
so like all those tensions building things of her in traffic and looking and like, oh, my God, there's my boss. And, you know, going over the long monologues in her head of what must be like that stuff just felt excruciating because I'm just waiting. And then they had that long dinner sequence. And I'm kind of like, Jesus Christ, when is the yeet, yeet, yeet going to happen? See, when it finally comes, it's like, wow. It's like 50 minutes into the film. And yeah. It like that. I spent so much of that first half of the film toe tapping because of this goddamn AMC horrors thing I watched like 20 years ago. It kind of not ruined the film, but it definitely it bled the effectiveness of it. Yeah.
I can get that. It's crazy because I had the opposite experience. I assumed that the rant stuff came at the very end because, you know, how are you going to kill the main protagonist 10 minutes into the movie? So I wasn't expecting it at all. I was not prepared for any of it. And when she gets in the shower, I'm like, this is exactly the imagery of the scene that I know is coming.
Sure. Is it like a prelude to the big
right
main event?
Is this foreshadow? What's he doing here? And then no, just happens. And I'm like, okay. And then it's interesting the change that happens. And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but the change that happens in the middle of this movie, because there's, you know, we had our main protagonist, but she's dead. So who is the protagonist now? And in some weird way, it becomes Norman Bates. It's
100%.
Even though he is complicit, well, he's an accomplice to this murder at this point, for covering it up and hiding it and all that stuff. But you're still like, you're looking at the car going, is that going to sink? You know, the detective comes by and you're like, is he going to figure out? I don't know if I want Norman to get caught here. It's a very strange feeling watching this movie.
Those are some points that really worked on me because those are lesser famous scenes that I did not know were coming. Like when the whole thing where they switch protagonist from Janet Leigh to the Perkins character. I keep on want to say Hannibal Lecter, but it's Norman Bates.
Yeah.
When they roll that car into the swamp and it hitches, I had to kind of like, what the fuck?
Right.
What the fuck is going to happen? Like, how is he going? And then it sinks in and he has that smirk. And I read that like Hitchcock, this was like a litmus test that he put in for test audiences because he wanted to go one step further from the voyeur aspect of just watching. He wanted you to be an accomplice in the crime. So he wanted you to feel that like, oh, my God, he's going to get caught. And I kind of don't want him to. And he heard like, you know, when the first screening he played it for, like there was like nervous kind of titters when the car stopped and then kind of like audible sighs of relief when it finally sank. He's like, I got him right where I wanted to. And that worked as well as like, I didn't know about the whole fucking private eye investigation.
Gotcha.
So like all that stuff that was going on with Arbogast, which is the only time I've ever heard that word is in connection to The Expanse.
Yeah. Same here.
And I looked into it and it's like some kind of like there must be some kind of meaning to this, but it's some kind of obscure Roman figure. Anyway, that stuff I kind of and then like when it started going into the home stretch and, you know, her sister and her boyfriend went out and put the screws to Norman. I got to back into toe tapping, waiting. You know, when she goes in and she sees the mirror, goes, and I'm like, that's going to be it. No, it's not that. And she goes down. Oh, fuck. Yes. The fruit seller, of course. But that stuff. Yeah, it's like I went into toe tapping mode for like the last act. And it was not great. And you know what? I think Hitchcock knew it, that this was a movie that really, you know, rises and falls on its twists. Because part of the marketing of this film was like he had cutouts of himself tapping a watch with a big thing saying the owner of this movie theater has been put on pain of death not to allow anyone into the theater once it has begun because, you know, the pristine experience is required for Psycho. And they had in the lobby, they had records playing that would have like the main theme. And then every 5 minutes be 5 minutes to Psycho, 10 minutes to Psycho, 5 minutes. So it's like this whole thing of like, oh, this is an experience and you must go in, you know, unspoiled. And I think he's onto something. Because when you know just the facts of the matter and you're just kind of waiting for them to happen, boy, it really that tension just does not build at all.
Yeah. A lot of movies aren't completely ruined by spoilers in the way that this movie is, I feel.
Sure.
Yeah. Because, yeah, you don't want to just be waiting for the big moments. You want to be engrossed in the emotion of the movie, right? You want to be pulled along on that ride that Hitchcock's trying to take you on.
And I think that it also hurts subsequent viewings because I imagine it's really rewarding to watch this 2 and 3 times to be like, God, you know, where were all the hints? Because there's a lot of, man, Hitchcock is really good. You mentioned about like the fact that like when you got to the shower scene, you're like, well, maybe this is a prelude. And I think it's because like he's done a lot of subliminal stuff. Like, you know, when you first see you first see Leigh getting ready. She's got white, you know, lingerie on. It's all very virginal and pristine. When she decides to take the cash, you see her getting dressed and she's wearing black lingerie. And then he kind of sets up her shower as like a baptism. Like she's decided, you know what? This isn't who I am. Yeah. I need to get my life back on track. I'm going to march back in, give this money, make it up and do whatever she is like starting to unburden. She's going to escape the trap she set for herself. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, more than any of the other shit, that's what does Norman in, because he just can't fathom being able to break yourself out of those cycles. Yeah. But yeah, in your mind, you're probably like, oh, yeah, well, this is just a shower and she's going to and then it's just all going to go pear shaped her trying to get back. Nah.
Yeah, I was expecting like Norman to go out and sabotage her car or something. And I'm like,
sure.
You know, all the kind of tropes of modern horror, but this is like somewhere between, you know, modern horror or, you know, modern slasher film and like classic horror film and classic suspense film that he liked to make. That's the other thing. Yeah. Some of the foreshadowing and then things that he's doing with shots, like in that scene where she's like in her hotel room and she gets killed and then Norman comes in and he's cleaning the scene up. The entire time that he's in there cleaning up, the camera is kind of following him with the money in the foreground. Like the shots that Hitchcock's aligning almost always have the money in them. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think that that's like, I don't know if that's a red herring. Like the money is a red herring in the entirety of the film, right? Like it's
literally a MacGuffin. He identified like he's one of the ones that pioneered the term MacGuffin, and he refers to the cash in this movie as a MacGuffin.
But to the people in the movie, it's kind of a red herring, right? It's like, well, they're going there, they're solving a murder, but the money had nothing to do with the murder.
No, not at all.
So it's kind of wild that he's like putting it front and center in these shots when Norman's going back, because Norman doesn't even ever discover it. He throws.
That's what I was thinking. I was going to ask. I was like, did Norman had no idea about the kid? I mean, that's the thing.
I don't think so.
Who knows how many people that Norman's killed over the years? But what finally tripped him up is this woman who stole $40,000 and made off with, had people that wanted her fucking found.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, there's no amount of because I looked it up. That's equivalent like a $400,000 in today's money.
Wow. Okay.
It's like half a, like, you know, secretary runoff, $500,000 from a local lawyer, a banker or whatever. Hell yeah. There'd be an investigation above and beyond just, you know, an attractive blonde woman. You know, fucking society loves to fall over themselves, finding them types, but add $500,000 of cash to it. And then holy hell. So yeah. And like, this concept of like voyeurism and putting the audience into the action, you know, like you got all these POV slasher shots, which becomes, you know, this is going to be inspire everyone from John Carpenter on down. Mm-hmm. He shot this film with a 50mm lens because that's the closest to the human eyes, I guess, aperture or field of view. You know, when people say that the camera adds 10 pounds, they're not lying. Like a lens that has a wider angle than that will actually reveal slightly more of your face, making it look fatter. It's not like the you that you see in the mirror is not the you that you see in a selfie. That's why you look, you know, you tend to look worse. So this 50mm lens actually made it look like you are seeing this thing. And I guess it probably works on a subconscious level, or it might be one of those things. Some of this stuff, I don't even know if it works. It just sounds like it does. And it When you read it, it's like, damn, that's cool. When you read it in the history books, right? You know,
sure.
But that's I think that worked because there's a lot of times where you are in the killer's POV. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of time where you are looking at things that you can't, you know, you're just watching, you know, someone's doomed, but you can't do anything about it. And being locked in that limited field of view, I think did a little bit for it.
Yeah. And all the stuff leading up to, I guess, the protagonist's death is, well, one of the protagonist's death is interesting. From a filmmaking perspective, I don't know how common this was at the time, but that scene where she's driving and she's sort of, I can't tell if she's imagining what the cops and the house, yeah, the real estate mm-hmm. office and the buyer is doing, or if they're playing the stuff that they are absolutely definitely doing over her just driving. It's hard to tell if that's in her head or not, but there is a smile on her face when they're talking, you know, they're going crazy about it. So I'm thinking she's kind of enjoying this, which says it's in her head. But it could also be happening.
Yeah, I had the same thoughts. Like, is this her imagining the effect that she's having, or is this kind of like this very rudimentary way of telling a split story where, you know, meanwhile, this, you know, like, just letting the viewer know that, like, things are, because, like, there's so many things when you read, like, the history of things like Casablanca and Maltese Falcon and, like, why the, I said this story a million times, but like why the editing feels so glacial is because filmmakers were worried mm-hmm. that like they would lose people. Like, you know, if you just have one guy like get up from his desk and then show up at the next location, people be like, what the fuck? Where are we? Who is this person? You got to show him walk across, open the door, walk across his lobby, get in the elevator, open the elevator, cross the lobby, get into his car, motor off, arrive at the establishing shot, get it takes fucking forever to transition these movies, but they were like, you know, these were ground, like Maltese Falcon is one of those, another like groundbreaking modern films where audience were like, holy fuck, this is going so fast. So like Hitchcock had to make sure that he, you know, put these breadcrumbs out for people to pick up on. And I feel like that's where a lot of this kind of dated shit where it feels is because we just, our use of like we are so contracted. And everything's like so like, you know, like it, at the time it was amazing that he had 70 shots in a 4-minute sequence. Well, your average music video has three times that much in
sure.
about the same amount of time. So like we are just much more visually sophisticated in storytelling. But mm-hmm. like this was, you know, this is super pioneering and innovative for. You know, 1960.
Yeah, it felt like it. That voiceover stuff. I know they did voiceovers before, right? But it's always like the hard-boiled detective talking about, you know, the night was dark and I was tired.
The dame's legs were long and
right. And in walks the damsel. Blah blah. Yeah, it's that kind of stuff. It's not like it's narrative stuff. It's not really like storytelling stuff. If you know what I mean, right?
Here they're establishing like, plot and furthering things, advancing things, you know.
Yeah, and nobody in this scene is telling you what's happening, right? It's just happening mm-hmm. and you're expected to pick up on it. And I liked that part of it. It felt more modern than a lot of movies around this time that I had seen do voiceovers.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Can
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
The other thing you mentioned is like the pacing of this movie and how audiences might get lost. I was surprised at how quickly this movie got into it. There mm-hmm. are two scenes. Then she steals the money and we are off to the races, man. It's mm-hmm. it does not waste much time with setup. Although I would say that like maybe the first half of this movie is set up in a way up until she dies. So yeah, I didn't feel like it was all set up though, right? I felt like when the subversion happened, I didn't go, well, God, they wasted all my time in the first half of this movie. Now I'm pissed off. I was more like, oh, that's interesting. Where's this going to go?
It does feel like, and I guess that Hitchcock was not very confident in this project. In fact, he intentionally shot it to where it could be separated into 2 hours of television and sold to a television network as like a two-parter event. And I think that's exactly where those things, like that scene is right at that like 50 minute mark, right at the halfway to, and there's even a bunch of visual cues, like the money is wrapped up in a newspaper that has this headline, just has the word new emblazoned on it. And once Norman kills her and he's going about cleaning, that newspaper is conspicuously in the foreground to suggest as if, in fact, a new movie has begun. We are no longer giving a shit about Janet Leigh and her travails, but this is about Norman Bates and whether he can get away with this this murder. And I think it does feel like it is two piece parts of a made for TV movie, because it was even shot, you know, to say he was doing everything he could to save money, like black and white. I guess partially a decision to make it not as bloody and graphic and crazy, but also budget saving. Sure. He didn't use a traditional film crew. He hired a television unit because they were mm-hmm. cheaper. So this does feel a little bit smaller and more intimate. It does feel like something that could be made. Now, no fucking way. I don't know what he would have to do this movie to get it aired on television in 1960.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, but, you know, reshoots are a thing, so.
There are probably networks today that wouldn't air this thing.
What did you think? Because, like, let's talk about how transgressive this movie was. Because we talked about the toilet thing, right?
Sure.
You know, the pee-pee-poo-poo
first
hole,
toilet ever seen by human beings, yeah.
But this is the first time, like, and the thing is Hitchcock is kind of a, he knew what he was doing. He knew the things that he was doing and why they would be shocking. Like when he shot this slasher scene, he says he was careful to never, you know, because he had to do all this. Like he hired a Playboy playmate to come out and stand naked in the shower for 3 days. So he get the can, you know, because I guess Janet Leigh is a little modest. And this particular Playboy model is famous for being a nudist. And she's just standing around being naked and getting the cameras and planning out all the shots and all that stuff. Because he said he wanted to make sure there was no nipples, and he also wanted to make sure there was no knives actually penetrating flesh.
Yeah,
however, freeze frame analysis will show that there is a conspicuous shot of that knife going into her abdomen about an inch or so. And there is at least one errant nipple. And he knew that these were in the film. And there was this, I guess, really shocking overhead shot of Janet Leigh lying in a pool of blood kind of pouring down the drain and all that stuff. And he told the editor that we're putting this in as camouflage. This is the thing where he's like, oh, Mr. Hitchcock, you've gone too far. You have to. This is just, and he's going to take that out so they don't notice the nipple and the knife entering the midsection. And he thought that the audiences would like you know, like almost what do they call that? Subliminally see the knife entering the woman and what the, you know, it's like, again, shock used Hershey syrup instead of blood because it was, had the realistic texture and thickness. Mm-hmm. And he actually stabbed the water, some sort of melon. I forget what type of melon it is, to get that kind of like wet schlicking into the human body sound. But that must have blown people away. I mean, we're living in the era of Suicide Squad, the Suicide Squad, and The Boys, and, you know, Kill Bill, and every graphic horror movie you've ever seen. But like, no one had seen this before.
Yeah, no, it's it worked. I thought I might have seen a knife or two go in, and I didn't notice any nipples. But that is a common tactic. Among filmmakers, even nowadays, right? Like, hey, we want to push this R rating. Let's put in some truly egregious shit so that when, because they need to come back and tell us that something has to be cut here because it is egregious.
Right.
And then, they put stuff in there specifically to be cut so they can hit their R rating. It sounds like Hitchcock might have been the inventor of that tactic.
a blade of armor. Yeah, because this is a very tame movie by modern standards, but you just keep coming back to, like, again, how shocking it was. One of the reasons that Anthony Perkins' career stalled out is because, you know,
the
dressing as a woman, being mind controlled by your dead mother, and slashing women to pieces was taboo on, like, multiple levels.
You
and
don't
people
say.
Just couldn't see him. People just couldn't see him the same way. It's just interesting how different, I guess, the times are and what blows people away. Like, for example, I guess there was a lot more lines to suggest an incestuous relationship between Norman Bates and his mother, which I actually picked up on. I had in my notes, like, that there's this one, I think it must be the one thing that survived the edit where he says, you know, a son's a poor substitute for a lover.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of lets it hang out there for a minute before Janet Leigh continues on to her shtick. So like, even with a lot of that stuff being removed, there's still that thorough, especially with our modern understanding of these things, like, yeah, Norman was probably molested by his mom, and who knows what other kind of unspeakable mental abuse that he went through. And then compounded by the rejection, you know, when she finally got a man and then he's no longer the star in her sky. Like, I felt that actually showed a really compelling look and sympathetic look at how a person could arrive at this particular type of crazy.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I would say that Norman remains a protagonist all the way up until very close to the end of this movie. Like, when you, you know, and there's some separation between Norman and Norman as his mother, right, too, that you have to do. It's like, well, yeah, Norman, the Norman half of Norman is kind of a victim of the mother half of Norman. It's an interesting twist. We'll talk more certainly about that ending here in a bit, but I some of the stuff I was picking up on that you were talking about with, like, the mother relationship being a little weird, a little too intense early in the movie, there's a lot of foreshadowing going on there that I didn't, you know, not knowing the end of this movie, I picked up on some weird level of attachment here, right, when he's talking to Marion. He's saying things like, you know, a boy is a mother is a boy's best friend, and I'm like, that's a little weird, that's not right. And then, like, you don't, you know, he's talking about not leaving the people that you're, that you love, and I get that makes a certain amount of sense, but all of this is like subliminally almost putting this idea of extreme over attachment in your head.
And
the performance there is what really sells it too, because he at times slips into a mode where he is a little bit unhinged, right? But it's not particularly dangerous, or it doesn't seem like it has a potential to turn to violence here yet. It's not until the end of the movie where you figure out how deep this goes. But there was always a tinge of that in the performance. But then he'd snap right back into being sort of a perfectly normal, nice guy. And Yeah, I felt that tension throughout the whole thing, just subliminally.
Yeah, and I think they're trying to, like, before they had the psychological words for it, kind of gesture at this concept of a split personality disorder.
Yeah.
Where, like, Norman Bates wasn't dangerous. You know, he's horny, maybe a little bit of a peeping Tom, but whenever his equilibrium of his situation, the balance of it got threatened by a romantic interest or... And it wasn't just like, you know, literally his mother possessing him, but like anytime the condition that led to his first murder, you know, that sense of like, oh, my God, I might have my mother being taken from me by someone or rivaled their affection, that his internal mother figure would take over and then remove the threat, remove the danger. So the status quo could continue. I thought that was pretty interesting.
There's a sort of like bipolar relationship there, right? Because Norman, his original sin was he killed his mother and her lover in a fit of jealousy, right? Because he was no longer the center of her world. Now his mother, through him, is going and doing that, right? So
because it's an expression of the guilt. It's like the guilt re-expressing and also the desire for his mother to still be alive, the inability to deal with her death. And like you said, that's one of the things I found very distracting is how many like obvious allusions to this, like the fact that he's a taxidermist, you know, he's surrounded by corpses that have been artfully posed to look like they're alive, you know, things like that. Like they really have. I mean, that's why I think it's a rewarding rewatch, is going through and seeing how much of that stuff. So you had no idea that he was the mother.
No idea. Zero.
So I imagine you're thinking that their mother is like some diabolical figure that is actually coming out to murder these people.
Oh,
yeah. They do a lot of good things. So like anytime you hear his mother hectoring him in the background, that's Anthony Perkins giving the lines.
OK.
But Hitchcock audio processed it to remove a lot of the bass and the timbre from his voice. And then he layered in a very slight ADR track with three different actresses kind of speaking as an ensemble. To like give it like it's recognizably Anthony Perkins when you go back, but there's still another quality to it, a feminine quality that they're bringing in. So like, and yeah, he's in two I guess that all works because like I'm here alone. Well, who's that up in the house? You know, like they have this thing where it's like the mother is the threat. The mother is the threat. And when he comes out screaming, "I'm Norma Bates," at the end, then I guess the mother was the threat. That's a sick shot too at the end of the movie where they superimpose the mother's skull over his face. Holy fuck, that's another one I didn't know that shot was coming, and that shot kind of a little spine chilling.
Yeah as they drag the car out of the swamp.
The way all that the multiple dissolve of his face kind of that like growing smirk because it's the mother it's the mother like inside him framing the son for all the murder, you know. And
does the mother think she's gonna get,
wouldn't even hurt to fly,
does she think she's gonna get away with it because of that? Like she doesn't realize she is Norman as well, and if he goes away she goes away.
The depths of the depths of the depravity the craziness is that they like he at some base level is not even aware that they're a separate entity,
right?
In fact, maybe the mother's just dominant now, like whatever was Norman is just pushed way down. That was kind of I thought that angle was fascinating, and like they even like the dissolve went from Norman in the cell smirking with his mother coming out, and then they overlay her skeletal face and then they overlay the car being pulled up, and but the way that all lines up is that chain looks like it's going around his neck, the way to superimpose like his mother drug him down into this lifestyle, or maybe it's a hangman's noose representing. But like, it's pretty sick there, Alfred.
Yeah. Especially with 60s.
Pull off some nice shots there.
Tech. You know, I mean the, you could easily do that nowadays. It took a little bit of skill to do that back then. Let's talk about some of the things I don't like about this movie, because we're in that section of the film. I think the end of this movie is both brilliant and ridiculously bad in ways. I think that the psychologist is one of the worst scenes I've seen in a film. It's terrible. But almost necessary.
It's cover your eyes bad. For the time, yeah.
For the time. Like, I'm thinking 1960, how many people are even going to know what schizophrenia or split personality disorder would even be?
Yeah, cross-dressing, all that. Like, you had to have a psychologist literally come in and be like, no, it's not. Just so people didn't get, because, like, I think that's another thing that, like, Hitchcock was deathly afraid that the censors, like, when a man come in dressed like a woman slashing people, they're like, nope, shut it. This is against all the and he had to have like a doctor kind of like, you know, no, that's not what it is. That's what it looks like, but it's actually just a type of criminal insanity. It's not some kind of sexual deviancy kind of thing.
Right. But that whole thing to a modern audience, to my modern eyes, is cover your eyes bad. I didn't need it, although I would argue that without it, it's just a big exposition about like,
the structure of the scene is bad.
I don't like the scene to begin with. I also think without that scene, that very bad scene that wouldn't be there in a modern movie because of, mm-hmm. you know, the sophistication of audiences has grown. Without that scene, the movie isn't very good, actually. Because how do you he does nothing in this movie to convey the resolution of it until that scene. Right. That scene is telling you everything that you need to know to understand this movie and what was going on with Norman Bates. Without that scene, this movie doesn't make any sense. So there would have to be, like, if you take that scene out, you have to replace it with a lot of other stuff that more artistically tells us what was going on with Norman Bates, right?
I feel like this movie is like an 11 out of 10, you know, again, for adjusting for its time and all era. If they just smash cut from Norman Bates being overpowered to him sitting like a jail cell slamming over him and going into that monologue about his mother and then pulling the car out of the swamp.
But that's like, to a modern audience. In 1960, I don't think anybody would have understood.
But people would have figured, I mean, you know, like we've gone through some mind bending films and like people figure it out. You don't need, like, Christopher Nolan didn't need to come in at the end of Inception and have like a smash cut to Michael Caine saying, you see, what's happened is there's an ambiguity between what Mal thinks he sees in the thing and the spinning top and the fact that he's so distracted by his love of his children. He doesn't even care what's real. Like, what the fuck? You people will fit. Yeah, you're right.
I guess so.
Maybe even a lot of people walk out and they're like, it's just like a big what the fuck, and it's thrilling and it's exciting. And then they talk to some of their friends, and then there's a newspaper article. Like I feel like it gets out, and you don't need that. Now, I think Hitchcock needed it because, like I said, otherwise I think the censors would get crazy thinking that this is some kind of subversive psychosexual, like, moral push. It already is all that stuff. That, but right. Like, you know, he was trying to defensively make the film. And unfortunately, it's much more modern film if you just take that out.
It is. Yeah.
And just skip all that. Just go right to him sitting in the cell, regressing into his mother. And I think that dialogue did everything. Like, yeah, people would figure it out what is going on there, especially with the overlay of her face and the juxtaposition of the car. But
I still feel like something would be missing, although I think you could, after careful study of it, yes, go back. But in the moment, I think it would be hard to pick up on what's going on without that scene. But the scene is bad. It's just exposition. And yeah, it's not particularly good exposition either. There's one other thing I don't like about this movie, and all of these are with the caveat that, like, this is a super ambitious thing that he's trying to do, and technology of the time and the storytelling techniques of the time were not up to par with what we have today. That initial crane shot that you talked about, you know, how good it is pushing into the window and the sort of rear window voyeuristic sort of vibes we get from it. Mm. Technically, it's not done very well. There are a lot of jump cuts. I admire what he was going for, but it does not look very good.
Oh, and Hitchcock agreed. He was miffed that, because he wanted to do that set to outdo, I guess, this famous, I haven't seen Touch of Evil, Orson Welles, but I guess there's like a banger 3 minute long oner to start that, that tracks people with the helicopter down a street and keeps on pushing it. And he wanted it out. He wanted to start off from five miles away and just get closer and closer and closer with one long tracking helicopter shot into that window push. And he couldn't get, So he has to, to settle for a bunch of slower, smaller shots that they then dissolved into. But there is still some technical brilliance because I don't know how they fucking pushed in from this brightly lit Phoenix, Arizona sun, white brick facade building into that window. And you can just make out some of the details of like Janet Leigh's stockings and like the handle of a dresser. And they continue pushing in that dark window. And then like the camera's eye, our eye, adjusts to the dimness. And we slowly become aware of what's in the hotel room. Now, I guess it's a very complicated shot involving the external thing, a miniature that was built that looked exactly like the outside of the building, and synchronizing that with the dissolve into the front. But like I, when I first saw it, as one of those things where I felt like watching 2001, where the steward just plucked that, it broke my brain. Like, those cameras did not have near the dynamic range to pull off a shot like that. How the fuck did he do it? And I still don't know exactly. I can say, well, it's like, you know, it's the shot and the miniature and the plate behind it. And the, but like, it is utterly convincing. It looks like you, the audience, zoomed in on these lovers, jumped in their window and let your eyes adjust to the dimness to see the illicit things going on inside.
True.
And it was, that's the thing. Like, that's why, like, I love these old movies, because even when they don't work because of pacing or like, and further back you go, you start running into acting problems where they just know how to fuck. No one had invented the method yet. So people are like, acting, you know, and that's like very jarring. But that is, but you're always seeing like the technical flashes of brilliance. And there's another here, like there's this looping crazy crane shot following the detective going up those stairs into the mother layer that, you know, and like it's. Yeah, it just kind of like bounds up and swoops and goes to the ceiling and then looks down and tracks this guy. And it's so absurdly dynamic. It's stuff we take for because we had drones and all this other shit now. But the time and attention it took to pull that shit off, you know,
and there are a lot of shots
was just crazy
that are like that. They're in some cases bizarre. There's one shot where Norman Bates is talking with the detective and he's like showing him the picture or something, and he's leaning in to look at it, and he leans past the camera, and the camera is just shooting the bottom of his jaw for like 15 seconds while he's just chewing these candy corn and talking to the detective, and it's a bizarre shot.
So I guess that shot was to
make you feel off kilter and like he's about to be caught or something.
There's a lot of bird imagery in this film, which I guess Hitchcock thinks is unnerving.
I mean, he made a whole movie about it. So
was supposed to suggest him, his long neck being like a chicken neck and him eating that candy corn like a bird pecking corn seed. It was literally just another big, you know, and there's like the Vivien Leigh's character's name or family name's Crane. There's a lot of like bird motif in that, and that shot is just to reinforce that motif.
Gotcha.
And it's intentionally weird, but you didn't get what it's supposed to do, which is make you think that Anthony Perkins is some weird bird man, which I don't know why that's inherently terrifying, but
not to me. Then there's one other shot that is very Hitchcockian, and it's the one where the detective is stabbed at the top of the stairs, or the private eye is stabbed, and the camera is doing, I forget the name of the technique, right? But it's where it's pushing toward you and zooming out, and it's giving this very strange effect.
It's like when Frodo first sees the Black Rider in the Shire. It's that exact, you're, I think it's, you're pushing in with the focus as you're moving the camera backwards.
I think you or can maybe do it both ways. Maybe it's, and maybe it's one of reverse, those will give you like an intense close up, very fast close up effect. The other will give you the opposite.
But it looks like the background's receding at an unnatural rate. Yeah.
And they do that at the top of the stairs, and it felt very much like a Vertigo style thing, right? Where the you feel like you're falling down those stairs with him.
I will say that, like, I felt like that's an incredible shot, and it's one of those things where, like, I admire the technical mastery and the imagination, but it doesn't quite work. It reminds me a lot of the final assault in Rear Window, where it's like, boy, the buildup and the psychological tension did not live up to the actual attack in the exact equal and opposite way that, like, the knife, because that knife attack is still kind of hard to watch. Like, it's not gory and graphic, but, like, the idea of this woman in this vulnerable area being stabbed to death by a larger, more powerful, and, you know, just to, I think it always is extra horrific when people are being stabbed, especially by, like, long knives, like, just the idea that steel running through your body is bone chilling, and this happens again and again and again, and she can't get away from it. It's distressing. It's 45 seconds. That part, even though I've seen it a million times out of context, that still was distressing, even 60 years later, with all the chocolate syrup.
And, you know, the filming techniques serve not to just make it scarier, but also hide the true identity of the killer, right? Which is great, because, like, if they're not going to show blood or the knife, they're not going to show the killer.
I'm actually amazed, and I guess this was Anthony Perkins was not on the set. They actually had three different women portray of three different sizes. They had a dwarf woman, they had like women at different heights and stuff to kind of get the unreality of the situation, but that's a woman, and they just kind of, like, tightly light her eyes. That's all you get the impression of this old elderly woman with a bun and these, like, crazy fucking eyes. I thought, because I was, when I saw the shadow coming in, I've seen the scene, but I don't remember. I'm like, I wonder how they hide the fact that this is, but they did a great job, and they just switcherooed it.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
And then obviously the music in this scene is iconic. It's about as iconic as music gets. It's this and Star Wars, right? For most iconic stuff.
The Jaws, like if you want to go like
yes, Halloween. I mean,
you have to wait.
Sure.
You have to wait almost 20 years to get a villain cue this iconic. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But I was surprised at how good the music is throughout this movie because I knew about the killing scene, the stabbing scene. I didn't know how good, even from the very beginning, right? That intro is really strong, too. The credits sequence.
Unsettling, yeah.
Yeah, it's disjointed. There's a you know, the music is doing the heavy lifting here. There's a sort of crazy tenor to it all. And that runs kind of throughout the movie. And it's used in places, a lot of different places and to greater or lesser effect throughout the movie. Like there's a lot of that when she's stealing the money and you're thinking she's paranoid and she's might be starting to lose her mind on that drive. And then, you know, later on it becomes not about her. But yeah, I was very impressed by the soundtrack of this movie.
Yeah, I thought that the main theme kind of kicking in during that long, you know, supposed to be a wonder, but it's not like is got that kind of like because you don't know what's going on. You just see like an establishing shot, a very particular date and time. And like, oh, what is this? And the movie and the music is, like I said, unsettling. And that's another thing is I guess the composer was paid hardly anything. And to make it worth his while, kind of like Hitchcock himself, he wanted to use a full orchestra, but he was limited to just using mostly strings.
Gotcha.
And that is what, in fact, and Hitchcock has said he also wanted everything in the hotel to have no music at all, to kind of, you know, highlight the unnaturalness and the inhumanity of Bates. But this guy crushed it so hard that not only did Hitchcock, in a rare instance of admitting he was wrong, like, no, your shit's way better. I was wrong to bust you out. He doubled the guy's salary.
Nice.
Out of his own pocket.
Yeah. And probably made a career for him, too. Honestly, like this is I don't know. I am unsure how well the audience received this and critics received this during the time. Was this considered?
Oh, it was wildly successful. This is the most money that Hitchcock ever made on a film. And
nice.
The studio tried to screw him out. They were only going to pay him like, I think his going rate was like $250. They're only going to pay him like $125, half that. He's like, well, you know what? If this movie's going to suck so bad, why don't you just give me some points on the back end? Mm-hmm. He made like the equivalent of $15 million on this film of modern day money. So yeah. It's a kind of a George Lucas tale where he had to kind of do it on a shoestring budget.
Why don't you give me the merchandising?
Necessity being the mother of the invention. Yeah. And he just like this movie made crazy bank because it was all like Hitchcock was good at this marketing, too. Like, you know, that he is the master of suspense and he's demanding you to be there on time or he's going to kill the fucking theater owner.
Yeah.
And I guess they had a really good television campaign where at the time it was popular to compare name brands to brand X unfavorably, and Hitchcock gets out there in his big, you know, kind of like you know what Hitchcock sounds like, and he's like comparing my movie to brand X, and he like opened up a curtain and it was just like hokey country western music because westerns were the dominant it's like the superheroes of today.
Yeah.
And then he goes and this is the name brand Hitchcock movie, and he opens up the shower curtain and you have like a stylized version of the Janet Leigh, her face getting screamed, and the music, and like everybody was abuzz to see this film, and the word of mouth of like, this is a fucking crazy, and it's like, you know, like you're going to be gasping, and it's kind of like, I guess, the Sixth Sense of its day.
It's interesting because I was trying to think of a movie that has happened in my lifetime where people have gotten this excited, or I guess the marketing has been this sort of in your face, because like the marketing now consists of trailers that drop and critic reviews. Right. And I mean, all, like people posting about it online. So
Well, that's our experience, right? I'm sure there's traditional things where if you watch football and network TV, you get some. But I'm thinking of
the creators, like Christopher Nolan doesn't get out there. Like, this is the equivalent of Christopher Nolan saying, "Fuck you, I'm not putting my movie in on streaming. I'm putting it in theaters," because like he's right. The auteur now, right? But he's not doing that kind of like showmanship stuff. He's just kind of being an asshole about things.
Yeah, the last few movies I can think of are the two obvious ones I go to are The Sixth Sense and The Matrix, because The Sixth Sense was heavily marketed as the mind blowing twist that you won't see coming, you know, and like you like this fear of missing out, like see it before someone can spoil you. And the What is the Matrix campaign from The Matrix, like just incredible hype for incredible hype for The Matrix.
Yeah, but you're right, they Shyamalan don't really has that yeah. element, but is he out there actively being that, or is that something that is
he started becoming the new Hitchcock, where they'd be like from the mind of M. Night, and like they did lean into like his, and probably to his detriment, the idea that like, oh, you know, another mind-blowing twist from the creator of Signs and The Sixth Sense, and eventually he just couldn't live up to that.
Yeah, but for like Devil or something, they're not playing his music in the lobby saying 5 minutes until Devil.
No, fuck it, no.
5 minutes until the doors like, lock and no one else can get in, right? That they don't do that shit anymore. It's such a mass produced mainstream.
The studio system is also just so much less powerful than it used to be. I mean, maybe we're getting that way.
For sure,
Disney's just going to like, you know, demand that people play Avengers music in the lobby of the thing. I mean, they could, but like, yeah, back in the day, holy fuck, like Warner, MGM, like they could just,
they all had their own theaters too, right? Like they were vertically integrated in a monopolistic way.
Jesus, we're going to recreate the old studio system for the...
Well, it's in the contracts that you can't. And I think like...
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the theaters and the studios have very specific contracts about what you can and can't do. And Disney is not allowed to own theaters. Like they broke that,
Is that a law or is that a contract? Because like I'm one. Because like
I think it's just an agreement.
Because I feel like we're 10 years away from there being from either AMC or Cinemark going out of business. Maybe Regal and Disney buys them up, and then because they just have such a lion's share of the output of movies that they can like make and break theater chains.
Oh yeah, so
unilaterally renegotiate terms like, hey, we're going to resolve our shit date and time on our streaming outlet and go pound sand if you don't like it. Or we might give you a week of exclusivity if it's make a movie or, you know, like stuff like that. So like
and, you know, theaters are trying to dictate, OK, you need X amount of days before it goes to streaming and all that stuff. And all those agreements are happening. But like there was, I don't know if it was a law or some agreement, but there was a very vicious fight. I want to say sometime around this era of Psycho over like studios owning theaters and trying to break that off, because it was just killing, you know, innovation and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Monopoly power tends to do that.
It does. It does.
how many times will we teach you this lesson, old man? Yeah, I don't know. What else do we have to say about Psycho? Because I think I'm about chocolate syruped out. I've my life's syrup has bled out onto the bathroom tile that is this podcast, and I just have a glassy, fixed stare into the camera.
Yeah, I thought it was very good. I was very impressed with this movie. So that's all
I
have to say.
Even though this movie did not work for me and I did not enjoy the experience, like I am not an asshole. I completely recognize its greatness. I can like, if I, and I'm so glad that Jim did have this experience because it kind of vindicated like, oh, this movie does still work. If you didn't, you know, if I'd seen all the big reveals of Rearview Mirror, maybe it wouldn't have been as cool as it was. So like, I'm glad we have both had these like different experiences with it, because I would hate for us both to be like, yeah, one of the greatest suspense horror films of all time. You know, and I think that's the thing. Like, I imagine there's a lot of especially Gen Xers, because I feel like, yeah, like millennials are too young to remember all of like, you know, their parents talking about this shit and, you know, seeing the, you know, the 20-year-old AMC.com things. But I imagine there's a lot of people in my age range that probably have not seen Psycho and feel like they have, and they might watch it and be like, what was the big deal? But
I was thinking my dad would have been like 20 when this movie came out. So, and this movie, are there movies that break the mold like this nowadays? Like how can you do it? Because I feel like everything has been done, and I'm sure they would have said that in 1960 before this movie came out, everything has been done, right?
Oh, I think you can, there's still Saw, boundaries you
I think
can push.
Saw was, a movie that broke a lot of boundaries
I'll go
did.
Back to The Matrix. Like, that broke a lot of, boundaries in terms of storytelling mm-hmm. and visuals. But I think, if I see social mores that are about ready to be destroyed, erect male penises.
Oh, on film,
you don't see them.
Yeah.
You can definitely we have moved the violence about as far as you can get. I don't know how you can get more violent than what they're doing in the Suicide Squad, The Boys, stuff like that. That's even intended to be PG-13 accessible type of stuff.
Right.
I think the where we are still far behind, particularly in this country, is the sexual stuff. Mm-hmm. Seeing dudes flopping around with boners is probably as subversive today as seeing, Janet Leigh rolling around in white lingerie, or mm-hmm. cleavage décolletage spilling out. So I think they can still push those boundaries. And you also see I feel like it's gross, but there's also a fascination with incest in popular culture now. Seemingly. I mean, it's like fucking there was a time on HBO where I don't think you could go a year without getting a plot having to do with incest. You had Boardwalk Empire, you had Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. I do feel like there are taboos, and every time I see it, there's an intense guy-on-guy sex scene in the first season of American Gods, where this genie is fucking a cab driver, and I remember thinking, wow, that's something you don't see every day. I think that's where the lines are, it can be pushed, because society has pushed the violence to where I don't even know. Yeah. What depraved, horrific shit you could do and raise people's pulses now. So,
yeah, I don't know, even from a filmmaking techniques kind of perspective, this movie was groundbreaking. And yeah, we'll see what The Matrix 4 does. I wonder if that's got anything.
It is hard because you're right. As things get more and more kinetic and drones and digital technology get better and better, The Avengers, in its way, Endgame was kind of groundbreaking. What Marvel did with it. So it still be a bit. It's just it's harder and harder. You break the sound barrier and it's a big deal.
Yeah, and then you're a couple years later, you go into space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I'm sure there will be something that blows the doors off.
Those kind of leaps are happening in video games all the time, because that's comparatively we're in the 1930s. In video games becoming a mature art form, mm-hmm. We're just at the turn of the, from silent to talkies and color, so where that still is happening, but movies, it's harder to innovate.
That's why 3D keeps coming back over and over again, right? 3D movies are trying to get
one thing where people add something new, it's something groundbreaking. Avatar made a shit ton of money, right?
Right.
Jaws 3D, that was a thing. Speaking of Jaws, guess what? Next week, that's going to be our classic horror movie, I believe.
Yeah.
We're going to do Jaws 1975. It's horror. I would definitely call it horror, right? And it's prestigious. I don't think there's any science fiction elements to it. I'm excited because I think that's another one where that movie terrified me and really changed my relationship with the water.
Yeah.
But I don't know how well the last third of that movie is going to hold up, because
technically the look of that shark animatronic
shark. I don't know. I haven't seen this movie in a good 15 years. So
same here.
And I'm going to try to watch it with my son to see if I can get those fresh shots. Cause I know he has no idea what kind of jelly this movie is going to be serving up, because there are some early on some horrific scenes. That's what we'll be doing to close out our spooky prestige movies. I wish there was a P word so I could alliterate, but I don't know. There's a scary P word.
Also, pterodactyl. Is it alliteration when you're saying it and it's a different sound? Because no, it's not like Psycho, yeah. Right?
No, it's not Psycho. Yeah, Psychotic. That's it. It's our Psychotic prestige movies. They both start with P. There you go. Okay,
prestige is the alliteration. Gotcha.
Yeah, come back for Jaws. Celebrate Halloween week with us. Thank you for listening to this prestige podcast. We'll see you next week for Jaws. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.